Good afternoon. I want to welcome Craig High School. Would those students please stand? Seeing you all, you're seated. And we have Chippewa Valley Technical College students. Would you please stand? We don't have Chippewa.
They got a better one.
But we have Beloit Turner students. Would they stand? Thank you for coming. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to attend an oral argument, and if they say they will come, they are sent materials about the case that they will hear with us, and then are invited to meet with a justice during the lunch hour after the second case, and the discussion is on procedures, not the substantive law. Did the Craig High School students meet with Justice Eaglin? Okay, and what about Beloit Turner? Okay, the three of you, if you can stay after the argument, we'll have a justice meet with you, talk about the procedures. If you can't stay, we understand that. The discussion was about the procedures, not the substantive issues of the case that were cases heard this morning or the case to be heard today. If anyone in the audience would like to have a summary of the case we are about to hear, the deputy marshal can provide one. It's easier to hear and understand and follow an argument if you know something of the facts and the legal issues involved. Anyone want a copy of the synopsis? Okay, let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Ziegler, with whom some of you met at lunchtime. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll now call our third case for today, 07AP 2024 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Anthony M. Welger. Walter Isaacson, Attorney Isaacson, State Public Defender, represents Anthony Michael Welger. Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Walter Isaacson. My co-counsel is Barbara Gerber. We're assistant state public defenders from Janesville, Wisconsin, and we represent Anthony Welger. In this case, the word nigger is the expression of a racist idea that all African Americans are inferior to all white people. And it's an incredibly stupid idea. We know that to be true because that idea has been exposed to the marketplace, and the marketplace of ideas has reached its verdict, and the verdict is that this racist idea is stupid. And Justice Brandeis once said that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and Justice Brandeis was talking about the First Amendment. And in this case, in the case of racist speech, sunlight has been a very good disinfectant. But today, the state wants to remove the sunlight. The state wants to ban the word nigger, give it governmental protection from the marketplace. And what will happen is the word and the racist idea behind the word won't go away. It'll just go down in the basement someplace in a dark corner. It'll still be passed on from generation to generation, and that's not really what we want. In fact, the likelihood is if the word were banned and voided, the sunlight and the disinfectant, it would regain some currency. Now, the words, the fighting words doctrine applies to words, you know, words that have a direct tendency to cause acts of violence on the part of the person to whom the words are directed. That's a direct quote from Gooding versus Wilson. So the word nigger is not a fighting word. There are no per se fighting words.
Mr. Isaacson, if I can interrupt you for a minute, don't you have to look at the context of where these words were being used? In other words, it seems to me that you can't just say, okay, the word was nigger, that's the word that was used, and it is or is not a fighting word. It seems to me you've got to look at the context. You've got to look at what was going on here at the particular time as charged in the complaint. And within that framework, a word could or could not be, depending on the context, a fighting word.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. In fact, every court that's looked at racial epithets or ethnic slurs has always wanted to look at the circumstances, the context that the word was used. But the context that they generally refer to is whether there were conduct along with the racial epithet, or whether there were threats made to the person, the victim, or whether it was a face-to-face context, or whether there was a hostile tone. Those are all things that courts have looked at.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the allegations here seem to involve a crowd of people, more people coming, apparently, as this confrontation was going on. I thought there were allegations that there was a Confederate flag that was brought out. Aren't all of those things relevant when you look at whether or not these words were indeed fighting words under those circumstances in that context?
Yeah, I think they all are. Mr. Weller wasn't the person that brought out the Confederate flag. And the fact that a crowd room, I mean, it's not crystal clear that the crowd was there just because of the words that had been uttered. There's no question that that's why the Confederate flag was brought out, and there's no question that a co-defendant came out and started, you know, using the word nigger again to the people that were on her property, to the gentleman that came to the property to complain about the, you know, use of the word, the racial epithet, you know, to the two young women.
Why are we talking about fighting words?
Pardon me?
Why are we talking about fighting words in this case?
Well, I think the state's taking the position that fighting words are proscribable under our disorderly conduct statute.
What's the difference? If it's a fighting word, is it disorderly conduct?
Pardon me?
If it's a fighting word, is it disorderly conduct? First of all, everybody agrees that there was only speech involved here.
Right.
And your client wasn't involved with the Confederate flag, so that conduct, if it was conduct, is not involved, right?
Yes.
And it's not clear to me, what did your client say?
Well, the allegation is that he used the word nigger when the two females walked past.
Okay.
And that the allegation is that he called them niggers. His explanation was he used the word with somebody else. But
okay.
In any event,
All right.
I think the state's taking the position that, you know, fighting words are proscribable under the disorderly conduct statute. And that's probably that's the position taken by the United States Supreme Court and most state Supreme Courts in the United States.
Isn't the crux of this case whether this is disorderly conduct? Now, you raised that issue even though the motion to dismiss was not appealed.
I'm sorry.
You raised the issue of whether or not this is disorderly conduct at all under the statute.
You mean in the brief to the Court of Appeals? Or the
in brief? Here, in the brief here, you raised that. But you didn't raise that as an issue in your petition for review. That wasn't the grounds for your coming up here.
Right.
So why are you arguing that?
Well, we got a directive from the court saying that whether it was a speech-only disorderly conduct or whether they were defendant.
And it's speech-only, right?
Yes, Judge.
But do you concede that this was disorderly conduct?
No.
No, I know. So if this goes back, state has to prove that, right? And you're going to argue it's not disorderly conduct.
Yes.
Well, aren't we here prematurely?
I guess that's possible. I think the reason it was, well, number one, the court asked us to brief that issue. And number two,
it says apply to the facts of this case, but we have no, we only have a complaint. We don't have facts in this case.
Well, I guess it is related to the other issue the court asked us to brief, and that's whether the hate crime statute was unconstitutionally...
As applied to the facts of this case?
Yes. Yeah.
But the facts aren't here yet, except on the complaint.
Well, I guess, at least insofar as those facts are concerned. I mean, I think we could... I don't think Mr. Walter would have a problem conceding that, you know, the word was spoken and there's no question he was charged. So I guess the issue is whether, the first issue the court asked us to brief is whether the hate crime was unconstitutional as applied to the facts of this case. In other words, the facts being that Mr. Welda either called two African-American women niggers or used that term when they walked past.
Counselor, I want to shift your attention a little bit to the statute that is the hate crime statute, 939-645. And that lists a number of categories. It says because of the actor's belief or perception about, and then it lists the categories, then the conduct is classified as a hate crime. That's race, religion, color, disability, sexual orientation, national origin, national ancestry, and these all relate to the object, in this case, of the speech.
Yes.
Now, there was some discussion by the Supreme Court in its decision in RAV that when you prescribe speech based on a prior restraint that's content-based, you have to be very careful that you're not saying, well, for example, fighting words are wrong in this context if you use the N-word. But if you were to say equally slang kind of words about a woman, could be fighting words, right? And we can all think of words without my giving you examples. But it wouldn't violate the statute. Okay. How does that dichotomy, in your opinion, fit within the discussion in RAV where Justice Scalia was talking about content-based restrictions that are okay, in other words, fighting words are okay in some places but not okay in other places?
Well, what I think the court said or what Justice Scalia said is you can't punish just certain fighting words, in other words, fighting words just based upon race, and as the court, as you just mentioned, allow words that might be sexist or homophobic, you know, fighting words to go unpunished. And that's kind of our argument in this case. I mean, number one, it's our argument that Mr. Weller's speech was not fighting words, but even if it were, it's his language, his use of the word nigger is being punished under Wisconsin's hate crime statute, you know, only because of his, I guess, expressive content or his ideas of racial superiority.
And that's how you started out, which is how Justice Scalia, I think, analyzed the statute from Minnesota that was before them, is that the proscriptions against using certain fighting words with regard to some circumstances, but not in regard to other circumstances, really is a prescription against ideas, not so much against the words.
Right, and I think that's what's going on in this case. At least that's our position, that the statute, Wisconsin's hate crime, is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Weller because it's being used to punish his idea or his, you know, feelings about racial supremacy.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between this and Mitchell? What's the difference between this case and Mitchell, in which the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of this statute and compared it to RAV?
Right, and I think the best answer to that question is that there's a case called State versus McKnight. I think it's in our, I know it's in our brief. And what the court said, the Supreme Court of Iowa said, that a person can use racial epithets and not be punished under the Iowa's hate crime statute, but if he includes conduct or threatening behavior, then it's not protected. And in fact, that's what the Supreme Court of Iowa said. The Supreme Court of Iowa said, when you take RAV and Mitchell and put them together, and the answer to the question is, a person, bigoted speech will be protected, but the conduct or the threats will not be protected. And it's almost like there's a bright line among all the states that have hate crime statutes, and the bright line is basically that if you know you can, if you use bigoted speech, you'll be protected. But if the bigoted speech goes beyond that to either conduct or threats, then it's not going to be protected.
But isn't that the point of the disorderly conduct statute, that this speech, under circumstances in which the conduct, and speech can be conduct, tends to cause or provoke a disturbance? So if it's disorderly conduct speech, it is not protected speech. If it's not protected speech, then why can't you have an enhancer?
Well,
that's why I asked you your first question as to your dispute that this is not even disorderly conduct. But once it is disorderly conduct, why can't you enhance it? Because it is no longer protected. Because if it were protected, it could not be disorderly conduct.
But I think that's right. It's but I think what every court that's looked at this type of case has said, it's not going to be protected as long as it's fighting words.
Now, are fighting words?
Well, fighting words are words, at least in the term of the decision of Gooding versus Wilson, those are words that have a direct tendency to cause acts of violence on the part of the person to whom addressed.
Yeah, well, and the disorderly conduct is words that, under the circumstances, tend to cause or provoke a disturbance.
Well,
and that statute has been held constitutional in this state a number of times. I don't think I've always joined the court, but that's what the court has said.
I know that, but even when it's been held to be constitutional, there's always some kind of limiting language. For example, in Douglas D., the court said abusive language carries with it either an implied threat, an express threat, or a challenge to fight.
Okay, well, this is abusive language, and it why doesn't it include a threat? You haven't tried that case yet.
No, I'm not saying that you say it's abusive language. The definition of abusive language that the Supreme Court, that this court has adopted, is that, and it's kind of in line with a fighting words language. You know, we don't have a fighting words disorderly conduct statute. So what the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court has done, is saying abusive, here's what it is. Abusive language carries with it an implied threat, an express threat, or a challenge to fight. And that's as close as this court, I guess, wanted to come to the, you know, the definition of fighting words.
Statute says indecent. Statute says profane. Statute says boisterous. So if it's loud and it's perfectly okay, but it would tend to cause or provoke a disturbance, as a misdemeanor.
I understand that. I'm just saying, at least from, you know, this case, it's not a question of whether it's loud or boisterous.
Right.
This question is whether it's abusive. And this court has come as close to, I think, adopting the fighting words definition as it wants to. And that was in Douglas D. And the reason it did that is because, you know, there was a constitutional challenge. In fact, if you look at hate crime decisions throughout the United States, they all say the exact same thing. You know, you can use the racial epithet or the ethnic slur, but it's almost like they've adopted a bright line. And the bright line is this. It's not going to be protected if there's threatening behavior or if there's conduct. And every case cited by the state, in every case cited in the amicus brief, it's the same thing. It's somebody out there using the word nigger or spick or faggot, and they always raise the same challenge when they come to court. They always say, I'm protected by the First Amendment. And every Supreme Court across the that has these hate crime statutes says the exact same thing. Yeah, you were protected when you use the word nigger or spick or faggot, but you're not protected when you start banging on the person's car and saying, kill the faggots, or you're not protected when you take the tampons and throw it at the Hispanic guys, or you're not protected when you take the African-American woman and pin her against the bar and threaten to cut her fat legs off. Those cases, in fact, in every single case in the United States that has these hate crimes, it's always the same thing. It's always this, it's almost like a bright line. If there's a threat or if there's conduct, you're not going to be protected. And that's what we're missing in this case. We have the word nigger, but there's not a threat to get the person, or there's not conduct.
Okay, last time, did it tend to cause or provoke a disturbance in the circumstances of this case? Yes or no?
Pardon me?
Yes.
Did the word nigger tend to provoke?
Under the circumstances of this case.
I'd say no question it did. Absolutely no question it did.
So it's disorderly conduct?
No, it's protected speech.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not, when you say it tended to provoke a disturbance, I mean, you know, somebody wasn't happy. The ladies went home, they told their father, he came down there and said, how come you're using the word nigger? Other people came, somebody brought out a Confederate flag, and then a woman comes out and says, get the niggers off my property. You look at the end result. Was there a disturbance? The police get called. No question about it, there was a disturbance. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Welder used fighting words, because they weren't fighting words. And they're still protected by the First Amendment.
There's a word that I wouldn't use.
Sure.
The initials are MF.
Right.
If someone said that, under the same circumstances as we have here, is that disorderly conduct?
Yeah. I'd say no, because actually there's cases that are reported cases where the person uses that word.
Okay. Now, it's, at least in my worldview, that's indecent.
Right.
It's indecent. So you have violent, abusive, indecent, boisterous, and reasonably loud, or otherwise disorderly conduct.
Or
it's
profane.
Indecent.
Pardon?
Profane, yeah. That's right. Could, I suppose it's both. Which one do you like better? Okay. It's either profane or indecent. And it's under circumstances which tend to cause or provoke a disturbance. Because you said that's what these circumstances are. So why those are the two elements of disorderly conduct, you have them met. So why isn't that disorderly conduct?
Well, the difference would be, you know, the MF word, you're probably not expressing an idea of, you know, white supremacy or that African Americans are inferior. And
I'm just talking about disorderly conduct now. Why isn't that disorderly conduct?
Just using that word?
Yeah.
I would say.
Under circumstances in which it tends to cause or provoke.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a word, there's a decision by this court, Lane versus Collins, where the person called the guy, the other, was a police officer, he called him a son of a bitch. And this court said, if you call somebody a son of a bitch under charged circumstances, then that's disorderly, or maybe disorderly conduct. And I don't have any argument with that. I think that's crystal clear. Yes.
I ask you, in this 939-645, this language about the actor's belief or perception, what is that all about?
I think that means that when the actor selects the victim, and he selects the victim, like if, for example, if you think this person's homosexual and you want to start calling him a faggot, then that was a case cited by an amicus brief, and so they started calling him a faggot and pounding on his truck and saying, kill the faggot. Or there were two gentlemen in there. But I think the perception is, in other words, if the perception of the person is, I'm sorry, Judge, if the perception is the person is homosexual, or the perception is that they're a member of this, you know, I think that means the state doesn't have to prove that they're actually a member of the designated group. I could be wrong.
What I'm really leading up to is this. Do you represent all three defendants?
No, sir, just Mr. Walker.
But any decision that comes out of this court will affect all three defendants.
I take your word on that one.
Well, are they convicted?
Are they?
Have the other two been convicted? Are their cases finished?
They're still pending. We're waiting for a decision of this court.
Okay. Another defendant, Mr. Wagner.
Yes, Judge.
Is claiming that, not that he didn't use the words, or the word, but that it was in relation to some criminal damage to property that occurred to him in Beloit. And he is the same defendant who apparently had a Confederate flag. Do we know any details about that?
No, I don't think there's any argument that he came out and waved the Confederate flag, and the officer, police officer, told him not to use the word nigger, and he kept using it anyway, and then he brought out the, you know, so I guess he brought out the Confederate flag before the police officer got there, but in any event, you know, I don't think there's any dispute about that.
What I'm really trying to get at is, suppose Mr. Wagner had a truck, or whatever it was, in Beloit. Suppose that truck had been damaged by African Americans, perhaps because he had a Confederate flag in or on the truck. First of all, would that be a violation of this statute on the part of the African Americans?
I think it would be, because that's like the Mitchell case where they said that they were... They selected the victim on the basis of his race, and if Mr. Wagner truck had been damaged because of his race, then the defendants in that case could be prosecuted.
Okay. If you accept as true, and I don't necessarily, but if you accept as true that Mr. Wagner's truck had been damaged by African Americans, is he any more entitled to use the offensive word than if nothing had happened to him?
I'm sorry, my time, may I answer?
Yes.
Because the red light's on. I'd say it doesn't make any difference. I don't think he's entitled. I think he's entitled to use bigoted speech and express these racist ideas. That's protected by the First Amendment. I don't think it improves any that his, whether his truck might have been damaged or not damaged. I guess the issue is First Amendment protection. And
may I ask a question before counsel suggests? Just
a secret.
Okay, I just want you to think about this, and you can talk about it when you come back up. But the statute 939-645 sub B, we've talked about the tail end of the statute, but the beginning of the statute almost seems to reflect the argument you made about cases around the United States that have dealt with the conduct part of it. So I'd like you to think about what, if anything, it means when the legislature chose the phrase intentionally selects the person against whom the crime is committed. So you've got a person against whom the crime is committed. Or selects the property that is damaged or otherwise affected by the crime. Those seem to be the beginning parts of when the hate crime statute applies. And I want to know what, if any, import there is to that language selected by the legislature when you're talking about disorderly conduct, which is really something that's more offensive to society as a whole, rather than the person against whom the crime is committed or the property against whom the crime is committed. I throw that out there for you to think about and come back.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Catherine Desmond Lloyd, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd representing the state in this pretrial appeal. As the chief noted, this is in the pretrial posture. So the question really, I think, is whether the complaint survives any constitutional challenge to it. The state asks that this court hold that the complaint sufficiently alleges probable cause that Mr. Welda engaged in disorderly conduct that is not protected by the First Amendment, and that the hate crime enhancer as applied does not offend any constitutional principles, and finally that the complaint doesn't violate double jeopardy because there is just one charge involved. As this court has noted and as the U.S. Supreme Court has found several times, disorderly conduct can be speech-only conduct. To be speech-only, the words have to fall outside of the First Amendment protection, such as cases involving obscenity or libel, or true threats, or, as in this case, fighting words. Fighting words are words that an average person would know tend to breach the peace or inflict injury. The content of the speech as well as the context surrounding the speech are what determines whether or not we have fighting words. Although the breach of the peace does not have to occur, evidence of it is relevant to determining whether the words are fighting words.
If it's disorderly conduct, if this is speech only, you concede that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to take your concession, but you can see that. If it's disorderly conduct, if this speech is disorderly conduct, then is it protected under the First Amendment by definition?
If the speech is
disorderly conduct, by definition, it isn't protected by the First Amendment.
That's true. If you find that it's fighting words under and disorderly conduct and the tests are very similar, then it's not protected speech.
And if it's not fighting words and if it's not disorderly conduct, then you've got another issue, right? But if the state prevails that this is disorderly conduct, then it's not protected under the First Amendment. Because if it's protected under the First Amendment, the state can't prosecute it.
Right.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Yeah. All right. Counsel, what about if I'm a Nazi and I'm marching in a parade right down the middle of Madison? It's a very liberal community. And I'm shouting usual Nazi slogans about, you know, white supremacy and the Aryan race and all sorts of things like that. And I don't have a parade permit. And there are a lot of people who get really upset at me and all of a sudden I'm in the middle of a brawl. Is that disorderly conduct?
I think that in the fighting words context of disorderly conduct, you have to generally, I think, be directing your words at someone. So I think.
Oh, what if I'm directing it at the people along the street while I'm carrying my banner with a swastika on it? I'm saying things to them as I'm walking down the street. Is that disorderly conduct?
I think that very well could be disorderly conduct. I think an average person would know that in the context of marching down the street in Madison, saying, you know, anti-Semitic slurs or whatever you're saying, would an average person hearing that might be incited to. Now, those people might be guilty of something else.
Yeah, I'm not worried about their conduct. Now, what if I've got a parade permit? I'm still a Nazi. I'm still carrying a banner that's got a swastika on it. I'm saying exactly the same thing to the people along the side of the street. Is that disorderly conduct?
Well, not knowing much about parade permits, but I think that
you're just looking at the speech.
Right, but I would assume in that kind of context you're going to have some sort of police protection, in which case you might be less likely to incite violence because of the
The ideas that I express are the same.
Right, but the context is different.
Well, yes and no. They aren't different to the person I'm directing it to. The guy standing on the side of the street doesn't like it any better that I have these obnoxious ideas and I'm right in his face telling him about it. So it's exactly the same conduct on my part.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that he might find it more permissible speech in the idea that he knows that it's been, that you've gone through the proper channels to express these things as opposed to just standing out on the street corner.
Okay, I have another question for you. Do you agree that this defendant is being subjected to a penalty enhancer based solely on conduct-based prior restraints on his speech?
Could you rephrase that? I'm not sure I understand.
Do you agree that this defendant is being subjected to a penalty enhancer, enhancer based on content-based prior restraint of speech? In other words, he's being subjected to a penalty enhancer because in his speech he said the word nigger.
I think he's being subjected to a penalty enhancer because he selected his victim based on race.
Okay, but you are still basing it on the content. But I mean, right? If he says the word nigger, that's what he's being penalty enhanced for.
He's being enhanced because he selected his victim. His disorderly conduct was directed towards two women based on their race.
And so we are saying then, if we agree with you, that he can't express that idea without being subjected to
potential. He can express
potential.
An idea. He cannot target a victim. He cannot engage in disorderly conduct directed towards a victim based on their race. He can talk about how he's racist, but he cannot choose a victim and use a word like nigger directed at them.
What if he used some really nasty slang words about women and he targeted them at me and put old women together, but with the lots of other slang that you and I can all think of? He doesn't violate the statute then, because the statute doesn't protect women and it doesn't protect people of age.
Right.
So it's just a certain category of people that he can't.
That he can't be enhanced by. Mm-hmm. That conduct would still be disorderly conduct if he used all sorts of,
right,
you know, anti,
right,
women slurs. But he cannot. The legislature, in its wisdom, has decided that that isn't worthy of an enhancement. And Mitchell has approved of that.
So
it's motivation.
He can't express his racist ideas to someone, as was done here, but he could express his anti-feminist ideas and pejoratives against old people, and that would be okay.
No, neither would be okay, as long as they're fighting
the statute. He wouldn't get his hand.
He wouldn't get enhanced. He would still get 90 days as opposed to 1 year.
So
it's his motivation that the legislature is punishing.
Okay, well,
enhancing.
All right. And the legislature can determine which motivations deserve enhanced penalty, just like the legislature. I mean, this has to be your argument. Just like the legislature can determine that crimes A, B, and C are enhanced or habitual, but crimes D, E, and F are not.
Right.
Well, mostly other crimes are not just speech, right? You carry and you conceal weapon, you're a repeater, you're a lot of things.
And the hate crime enhancer doesn't have to be just speech, it just happens to be speech.
In this case.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But yeah, the legislature enhances penalties on domestic violence cases or on, you know, there's all sorts of motivation based, and even just judges at sentencing generally are often taken to
account. Counsel, that last portion in regard to speech-only conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Your opposing counsel noted that historically the application of these kinds of enhancers and penalties are coupled not only with the speech, but coupled with some kind of actual physical conduct. Are there other cases out there that you're aware of where it's been upheld that simply the speech alone, uncoupled with something, some overt physical conduct, can serve as the kind of enhancer that the state is seeking here?
I'm not aware of any, but I don't think that means that it can't be charged this way, just because it
I
has.
I understand your belief. I presume you wouldn't be advancing your argument if
right.
You did.
No, I think, I mean, a lot of other states don't have it as an enhancer. They have it as a substantive crime. And so I think that it's hard to find other jurisdictions that would even penalize it in this way. And there's just different ways that they go about doing it. But no, I have not found any case that there's an enhancer applied to speech like this.
Is this case more about whether or not the conduct is disorderly conduct? Or is it about the validity of the penalty enhancement?
Well, I think this case has changed a bit since it started in the circuit court, but I understand it to be more, this obviously could be very wrong, but I understand it to be more about whether the state is permitted under the Constitution to charge disorderly conduct in this type of, in what's set out in the complaint.
Where do you see that in the petition for review or in the two questions we asked?
Well, I did see it in the petition for review. I guess I inferred it from the certiorari. I guess the second question, whether this is in fact a speech-only disorderly conduct case or whether the facts would support the disorderly conduct charge.
Would you all agree it's speech?
I concede, the state concedes that this is speech.
Well, so does the defendant. So this is, in fact, a speech-only disorderly conduct.
Yes.
You think it's disorderly?
Yes. Well, I think that I think that the complaint alleges probable cause to find it's disorderly.
Are all disorderly conduct speech cases, if you can get a conviction on disorderly conduct, and there's no First Amendment basis for challenging that, would that automatically allow an enhancement, assuming there's been a selection of a victim on these grounds?
The state would have to prove it, but yes, yeah. I think so. I don't see why not. I mean, after Mitchell, I don't see why you would single out the disorderly conduct statute for being a statute that the enhancer can't apply to.
Well, what about this problem in this case, and I've forgotten where it is in the briefs, that says, hey, okay, it's speech only under disorderly conduct. Okay, it's disorderly conduct, but it's not under 939 645 under the enhancement because the defendant here didn't select the person against whom the crime is committed. There is no person against whom the crime is committed. It's general society here.
So not you're saying in just a general case where somebody is a speech-only disorderly conduct,
yeah.
It's just society.
Let's assume it's speech. Let's assume it's disorderly conduct because it's under the circumstances provided. But it doesn't come under 939.645 because where did Mr. Welder select the person against whom the crime was committed?
I think he selected the two women that were walking down the street.
Well, was it disorderly conduct when he said the words to her or them?
Yes.
Immediately?
Yes. As soon as they came out of his mouth and they heard them.
So if I walk down the street and I say something profane, let me whisper it to somebody. No one else?
Justice Cook sent to me.
Let's assume it's profane.
Okay.
And he doesn't take a poke at me, and he says, well, another nut down the street to himself. Doesn't say it to me.
You don't take a poke at me,
yeah.
Right? I'm worried.
And so is that disorderly conduct?
No, because it's not a fighting word. Or it's to be speech only, I think you have to still fit into one of the categories like fighting words or true threats, etc. And in that situation, you don't have such a word that anyone, the average, ordinary citizen, would expect Justice Crooks to breach the peace.
So the N-word is a fighting word.
Very well.
The N word is a fighting word.
I don't think it is in every context. I think that it certainly is in this context.
Is when used by a white person against a person of color.
In this kind of situation where there's strangers and there's, you know, they're in public place and there's nothing, you know, there's no disarming smile here or any evidence of it, at least at this point. I think that the context, I don't know how you could honestly say that this wouldn't be something that an average person would expect a breach of the peace to ensue from.
I'm trying to construct a hypothetical. Let's suppose two people are living in respective duplexes, and one is an African American, and one is white. If the white person plays stereo extremely loudly, under circumstances that we'd all agree would be disorderly conduct, would that be subject to a hate crime prosecution?
Well, without more, I don't think so. But I think, I mean, if there's some evidence that this white person hated this black person because he or she was black, and the prosecution could show that this was motivated by race, I suppose there could be the enhancer there. But I think that without just loud music playing two different races, I don't think that's...
Well, I mean, there's only one person in the other duplex.
Right, but there's many reasons you could, A, be playing loud music, or B, not like your neighbor,
but it was 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I'm not saying that it's
not... There aren't any houses close by. You have to draw an inference here, don't you?
I draw an inference that one person plays music really loudly at night and maybe doesn't care about his neighbor, but I don't see any race-based decision to play that music at 3 in the morning.
The reason I asked you earlier the question, what are we here for? Are we here for the penalty enhancement, or are we here for seeing if this is disorderly conduct? I don't know why we'd be here for the penalty enhancer, because I think that that decision was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in Mitchell, and whether or not it's a penalty enhancer, in my mind, whether or not it's a penalty enhancer that attaches to aggravated battery, or regardless of what the charge is, there's a validity of the penalty enhancer, but I understand that it may be as applied. So I'm a circuit court judge in Wausau, Wisconsin. And I was a circuit court judge in Wausau, Wisconsin. And in Wausau, a large population are the Southeast Asian, large Hmong population. In fact, in the high schools, about a third of all the students in Wausau West are Southeast Asian. And if I were a judge and there's a situation where there's a complaint, now we're talking about if there's probable cause for disorderly conduct, and the situation was there was two high school students who were Hmong and Anglo, white, and they were walking by, and it was kind of a situation that was already a little tense, and they said, Hey, Chink, get out of here, Chink, go back to Vietnam, woo, you know, I mean, we're surrounded by others. I don't know if the persons are guilty or not, but I guess I'd say there might be probable cause to believe that there was disorderly conduct. So what's the difference between my hypothetical and what's going on here as to the underlying charge of disorderly conduct?
I don't think I see a difference between the two. You know, the ones in Wausau, one's in Janesville, and the races are different, but I think it's the same single, you know, using fighting words and directed at somebody, and you would expect in those kind of situations that you would get a violent reaction.
it would seem to me, for me, the issue in this case is not certainly not the validity of the hate crime statute. It is really how far do you extend that statute? Do you apply it to every single crime between 939 and 948? Are there any that shouldn't be applied? Particularly in a case where it is a matter of only speech. I mean, I don't think you can go too much beyond what this fact situation presents.
And that may be true, but I think it's a decision that the legislature has made that this is, and that the U.S. Supreme Court has approved of, and I don't see that this, this might be the outside boundary, but I still see it within the permissible charging decision, and U.S. Supreme Court as well as this court's case law.
Well, the statute says any crime under 939 through 948. Complete. Right? Covers disorderly, right?
Mm-hmm. But there could be circumstances where there could be a hate crime and disorderly conduct. There can be batteries that are also charged as disorderly conduct, and you could have two counts, and that could be something where there's conduct that evinces the hate crime part of the statute. Part of the problem I'm struggling with is what I mentioned earlier, and I haven't heard you address it, except that you said the two women were the persons against whom the crime was committed, but disorderly conduct at that point wasn't fully realized, was it? First off, and second, taking Justice Bradley's scenario where you have people making ethnic slurs against a couple of other people, let's say the white person in her reference is a female, and they make a very significant slur that's not race-based, but female-based against a female. They're all guilty of disorderly conduct, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
But the white female could be charged with a hate crime, and the two Hmong people could not, even though fighting words.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and that's taking the second question first. That's what the legislature has determined, that the race-based conduct is somehow worse than gender-based speech. I mean, it's just, Mitchell has approved of that in taking into account someone's motivation, and the legislature has determined that society doesn't tolerate race-based crimes, or tolerates them less, I suppose, than other crimes. They're just punished more severely, although both are punished. And as for the first question, I think that disorderly conduct with regard to Welda had occurred by the time he said nigger to the women. I think that that was the completion of his crime, because
You're saying in that instance the public, society, isn't the victim of disorderly conduct. You're saying it's these two women who
right.
are the victims.
I think disorderly conduct can be just a societal victim, but you can also have specific victims in disorderly conduct cases. I mean, that's fighting words is, by definition, fighting words, you have to have a victim. You have to have somebody that has been addressed.
For fighting words. But you keep saying fighting words and disorderly conduct. You could have disorderly conduct for swearing. You can
right.
have disorderly conduct for doing a lot of things that aren't necessarily fighting words. You don't have to have a fight occur in order for someone to engage in disorderly conduct.
No, and you don't have to have a fight occur when you engage in fighting words either. But the state's position is that in this case, the use of the term nigger at these two women were fighting words, and that's why it's prescribable under disorderly conduct statute.
How do you reason through a content-based prior restriction on speech? Do you rely solely on your conclusion that this was within the category of fighting words, so therefore you don't have to worry about what kind of scrutiny you apply to the legislature's choice of this statute and its application here? Is that what you rely solely on that, or is there something else?
No, I think that that's what I'm saying. It's that it's not just the content, it's the context, it's all of this, and this is also, again, in the probable cause stage. So just at this point, there's enough to show probable cause that these were fighting words, which are prescribable under.
Okay, I'm going to assume for my question, because I really want to be sure I understand where you are. I'm only concerned with the enhancer. I am not concerned with the disorderly conduct, just so you and I kind of are on the same page. And my concern is that this is a content-based prior restriction, okay? And if I understand what's in your brief, you're saying it's all right that it is because these were fighting words. If they weren't fighting words, then you couldn't have a content-based restriction. Am I right so far?
Can you think about that for a second? I think... I think that the reason the enhancer is constitutionally applicable here is because it's not proscribing the crime. The crime is disorderly conduct. It's just punishing that crime more seriously because of the motivation of the speaker, which the Supreme Court has approved of.
Okay, that's okay. I'm probably not phrasing
it. So why are we
talking about prior restraint? This is not a prior restraint.
Yes,
prior
you can't say certain words.
Prior restraint isn't that you have an injunction ahead of time that says you can't publish that. That's a prior restraint. If you publish it and then you're punished, that's not a prior restraint. Anyway, that's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
That is, but I'm not no expert on First Amendment.
So, we can avoid the words prior restraint. We can say, if you've got the question I think that's being asked of you, but I could be wrong, is if you have disorderly conduct for this speech, can you automatically, assuming you fall within the prerequisites, can you, once you've got a disorderly conduct, if you can satisfy intentionally select the person, on the basis of the belief or perception regarding race, etc., then you can enhance it. That's your position.
I don't see any reason why you couldn't. I understand there's sort of a gut reaction to this case as being kind of odd with the speech only and the enhancer, but I don't see any constitutional reason why, if this is disorderly conduct, it can't be enhanced under the enhancer.
But there's a basic problem as to whether this is disorderly conduct.
Right, but at the pretrial stage, I think that the complaint is sufficient.
So we have to go on the grounds that there is disorderly conduct here, because that isn't what's appealed.
Right.
I agree. Do you have anything else you want to say?
No.
I mean, look at your notes and see if you want to say anything else.
Good job with a lot of hard questions.
No, I think I think I've said everything I wanted to say. So I just ask that you affirm.
Thank you. Just a minute. Justice Prosser has a question.
We know the offensive word here. If a person were to say that word to you, result there.
I don't think you have a disorderly conduct case. I don't think you have a fighting words case. I don't think anyone would. I mean, I think you might expect me to be annoyed or puzzled, but I don't think you would expect that I would react violently to the use of such word against me. I think that's why the fighting words doctrine depends so much on the circumstances, and it's so fact-specific. And as opposing counsel said, there are no fighting words per se. The state agrees with that. It's the context and the content and all the surrounding circumstances that you look at.
called you a honky?
You want to try it?
I have no further
comment. Now, again, I think under those circumstances, it's just not the inflammatory. I mean, this word is so inflammatory. We all have trouble saying it, even when we're just talking, you know, we have to talk about it in quotes. It's just so awful. And under these circumstances, it not only tended to breach the peace, it did breach the peace. So I think that it's certainly prescribable.
Let me give you another circumstance. Friday night dance, late, little bit of drinking, shouldn't have been going on. Six young women. One starts calling another, you slut.
Ooh.
Is this in Wausau?
No, this would not happen. Wausau. This would not happen. In those circumstances, do you think there might be probable cause for disorderly conduct charge?
I think that's, I can see how that could amount to disorderly conduct. That's another pretty inflammatory word in, you know, situations where it's not said in a with a disarming smile, and it's said, you know, to be cruel.
Well, with that, maybe that'll end the questions. I don't know, Justice Brasser, dare you go forward again? All right, if there are no further questions, and your red light is on.
Thank you.
We'll, excuse you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Isaacson?
In response to, you know, the question about whether disorderly conduct is a victimless crime, there's this case, it's called State versus Vinje, V-I-N-J-E. It's a Court of Appeals case where the Court of Appeals said that there may be a victim in a disorderly conduct case. Justice Sundby was, dissented and said, felt that it was a victimless crime. And generally, I think it is probably, most of the time, doesn't have a victim. But
society is the victim.
Right.
I mean, it's the notion that in a reasonable, civilized society, we don't behave in such a manner that we would do things to cause or provoke a disturbance.
Right.
Society is generally the victim. And that's why I asked the question, because the statute says person or property.
Right. In fact, you know, we made the argument that it shouldn't apply because, you know, there isn't a victim normally in a disorderly conduct case, but there is, you know, obviously that case where, and there was a petition for review that was denied, and so.
What percentage of disorderly conduct cases that you handle deal with things like domestic abuse where there's an individual victim as opposed to society at large? Is there any?
I'd say it's probably 90% would be the domestic, some type of domestic incident. I mean,
so
the other 10% would be the bar fights. But, you know, obviously this isn't the normal case.
You noted earlier, speaking of normal cases, you noted earlier in your initial presentation, and your opposing counsel agreed with you in response to my question, that typically, historically, punishment for this kind of conduct has usually been coupled with some kind of overt physical act. And your opposing counsel is unable to cite to any precedent where it's speech alone. But doesn't the RAV case essentially address that by saying, but when the Supreme Court, my understanding of the holding there is that the United States Supreme Court said that fighting words, although verbal in character, essentially take the place or are the non-speech element of the offense.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And we agree with that.
How do you get around that?
Well, the way we get around it is because use of the word nigger without anything else is not fighting words. The Supreme Court of the United States has defined fighting words as indicated before as having a direct tendency to provoke an immediate violent response from a person.
And that takes you back to Justice Brooks' original question to you during your initial presentation about context. in this context that we're dealing with, we're focused on the complaint. And right now we're at the probable cause stage, and as Chief Justice Abramson pointed out, she said this thing hasn't gone through, jury hasn't gone through fact-finding, so we're looking at the complaint. Under these circumstances, as recited in the complaint, I think you indicated there would at least be probable cause for that.
Not probable cause for fighting words, probable cause maybe for a court to say that the use of this word, you know, was disorderly. But I really don't believe that there's probable cause to find that there were fighting words.
Why not?
Well, number one, there's all these surrounding circumstances. It wasn't a face-to-face context. There weren't any threats. There wasn't any conduct on the part of Mr. Welda. None of these things that are generally courts look at to decide whether they're fighting words. Even there wasn't even a hostile tone, at least alleged in the criminal complaint. So there's nothing that generally supports the finding of fighting words. In fact, it's almost the exact opposite. Instead of a violent reaction or something like that, women just kept on, you know.
So in order to rule the way you would want us to rule, we would have to say, we'd have to look at this complaint and say, as a matter of law, it wasn't fighting words?
Well, I'd love to see the court do that. Maybe the court can't do that, but I think at least the court could say that, you know, the hate crime in this contact doesn't apply. That was basically what the circuit court said.
But you'd have to get there by saying it doesn't constitute fighting words.
That's correct. And
jury question?
Pardon?
Is that a jury question? Because it's fighting words in context. Is that a jury question about whether or not this is abusive conduct that provokes? Isn't that a jury question?
Well, unfortunately, it is, and the problem. My red light's on. Is it okay if I?
Well, we want to hear what you have to say.
Well, the problem is, you know, the jury doesn't get much guidance in deciding what's abusive language from the jury instructions. It's abusive language that tends to, you know, create a disturbance. And you know, we have on the one hand the jury instructions and the statute, and then we have the other hand the interpretation of this court of what abusive language constitutes.
Well, doesn't it either has to be answered by a jury or as a question of law?
Yeah, and I think this court could find that, you know, as a matter of law, the use of that word under the circumstances alleged in this complaint are not fighting words.
Is this a prior restraint? Does prior restraint have anything to do with this case?
Well, I guess in the normal prior restraint cases, maybe not, but there's the, I guess that's the idea of we're taking this statute and telling people, you know, you can't be using.
That's your overly broad argument.
Pardon me?
That's your overly broad argument.
Yes, sir.
But that overly broad goes to the face of the complaint, face of the statute, not an applied challenge.
That's correct.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson, and thank you, Ms. Lloyd, for your arguments. And as always, free speech is a very interesting area and complex, and thank you for your arguments. That concludes our argument in 07-AP-2024-CR, State of Wisconsin versus Welda. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. The court's in recess until next week, when it will hear its last set of oral arguments for the April month. We are in recess.